Thanks, Kurt. I always wondered who bought that other tape. But you know, this past year I ran for the Nevada State Legislature, and if I'd have had this many people any time I spoke there, I might have gotten elected. Yeah. Of course, at least at this one, I probably know more about what I'm talking about. My name's Keith Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. I really want to thank Kurt for inviting me here. I appreciate this opportunity. I always consider it a real privilege to be able to speak to a room full of my peers. I always feel real comfortable. There's one thing I'd like to do first, if it's not out of order here. Yeah, I'm going to do it anyway. I wonder if all those people that got chips tonight could stand up one more time. Could you stand up for me, please? They represent milestones in recovery, and that's what we're all here for this evening. I certainly hope so anyway. It's about recovery. That's what I hope that the gist of this talk that I give tonight, I hope I focus more on the recovery than the disease, and I have to be careful about that because you get started off being drunk and you stay there sometime. And, you know, I don't know, I guess... I've always kind of looked at life like a parachutist does for some reason. Now, when you jump out of an airplane, that's being born. And when you hit the ground, that's when you die. But sometimes there's a lot of interesting things happen between the time that you go out the door until you actually land on that ground. Some people land because they've gotten a lot of good directions. They don't land so hard when they hit the ground. Some jump and they have a static line that within just a short time after they leave in the airplane, why, their chute automatically opens and they have a pretty gentle trip down to the ground, you know, and they don't seem to have to do a lot. It's just how they have received some good basic training on the ground, and they just seem to do things right in life, which is pretty good for them. Then there's some that seem to go out the door, and even though they might have a static line on, it opens, and, you know, it's like a candlestick or something. That main chute goes all to hell on them. And they have a reserve. And depending on how well they handle that reserve is... depends on how their life goes. Whether they get by fear and they're overpowered by it and they just freeze and paralyze and they don't do anything and they go on down and they hit the ground. Or if they do what they've been taught to do and they open it and they spread that chute out and it kind of catches them and they gently float on down. And I think there are the alcoholics who are the skydivers. They come out that door hell-bent for election, and the thing that they try to do is to see how close they come to ground before they pull the chute. And being good alcoholics, a lot of us misjudge. I think I was one of those. It's so interesting looking out here tonight and seeing so many familiar faces. And at the same time, I go to a lot of meetings and seeing so many unfamiliar faces. I'm glad to see this exponential growth that's going on in Las Vegas and Alcoholics Anonymous, because I know that that's being duplicated all over the world. And as soon as there's more of us than them, we'll be the ones out there and they'll have to go to meetings. I like that. This past week, I noticed on the news that the Canadians up there have come up with a feel as a new discovery for the disease of alcoholism. I always watch for those things, you know. They might get it some of these days. This was kind of interesting. I guess this drug that they have there was first used with heroin addicts. And supposedly what it does is that they give it to them and it blocks the pleasure center in their brain or something, so they derive no pleasure from it. And now they're using it on alcoholics. Well, I don't know about you, but I've got some news for them. The last few years drinking, I got no pleasure out of my drinking at all. So, shit, I'd already stopped that, and I kept drinking. So I don't know how that's going to work, but I'm going to keep it checked. I have a little problem with this drug therapy situation anyway. Drugs and alcoholics, I don't know. They don't seem to go too well. Matter of fact, Friday night, I have this little impotence problem, and I took this pill for impotence. And I must not swallow it fast enough because I walked around all day Saturday with a stiff neck. For my friend, Suana. Glad to see John pick up his 9-month chip. If he were speaking here tonight, he'd tell you it's a breeze, it's a piece of cake, and... Well, maybe it's not quite that easy at first 9 months. I'm still really amazed when I see someone pick up a one-year chip. It took me 13 years to get a year in this field. Now, that doesn't speak well of me. It doesn't tell you anything about the program. The program never changed. The opportunity was as great the first evening that two gentlemen knocked on my door as it is tonight. There are a great number of people who go to their first AA meeting and never have to drink again. That's one of the things my sponsor said. When he looks at newcomers and everything, he says, you know, you never have to drink again if you don't want to. Now, if you don't want to may be the key to this thing. I don't think at the time, as a matter of fact, my first AA meeting, I was sober. I'd been involved in a DUI in Phoenix, Arizona. It was in 1965. I was 25 years old. And when I got locked up that night, early the next morning, my first phone call was to my sister, which was not unusual. And I said, I've got a little problem. I wonder if you could come down and get me out of jail. I can't afford to miss any work. And she said, what are you in jail for? And I said, well, it's no good. She says, what? I said, what? She said, were you drunk? I said, well, that's what I said. No, I... She said, I'll come down and get you out on one condition, and that's I have someone that I want you to call when you get home, and then I want you to see them tonight. When you're in jail, what do you do? Of course. Of course I'd be happy to do this. Come on down. She came down and paid my bail. We went to her house. She dialed the phone. I got on it. I said, hi, my sister Evelyn had suggested that maybe I ought to call you. I got in a little problem last night when I was drinking, and even though it's not serious, she wanted me to call you. And he says, well, could I come over and see you tonight? And she's standing there, you know. I says, well, sure. And he says, well, great, I'll be over about 6 o'clock, don't drink. It's okay. Now, in those days, I could go all day without drinking. I really could, especially when I needed to get out of trouble with somebody. And right at that time, I needed to get out of trouble with my sister. See, about 3 weeks before that, she'd gotten me out of jail for drunk driving. And on the way home, I said, I need a pack of cigarettes. So she pulled up in front of a Circle K, and she looked in her purse, and all she had was a $5 bill. And I said, I'll run in and get them. And she said, no, you won't. I'm not going to give you this $5 bill. I'm not stupid. You stay in the car, I'll go get the cigarette. Another mistake. She went in there, but she left the keys in the car. I drove off, sold her spare tire, and got drunk. You know? My family loved me. We were a very close family. However, this time, I had really gotten into more than what I had bargained for. You see, who I thought would come over there would be some counselor, some therapist, some psychologist, and God forbid, another minister. Thing is that I had seen enough of those people over the years, I knew exactly how to handle them. And you know, an hour with them, I could blow it off, and I would be back in the good graces of the one sister who would still bail me out of jail. Well, 6 o'clock came, and I can tell you, promptly at 6 o'clock, there was a knock on the door. And, of course, I had to answer it because my wife was there and she was not speaking to me. We had these problems every time I stayed out for 2 or 3 days. She would go a couple of days without speaking to me, and this was one of them. But I opened the door. I immediately knew there was something wrong here because there was two men standing there, and they were both smiling. And that scared the hell out of me. You see, I'm accustomed to psychiatrists and psychologists and preachers and all that, and they're serious people, and they don't see anything funny with anything about people who drink. And these guys were smiling. So I invited them in, and we sat down at the kitchen table, and in those days, I was still a reasonably nice person to be around, and we had a cup of coffee, and they said, well, tell us what happened. And I said, well, it was maybe it was just because it was late or something. It was around 3 o'clock in the morning, and I come through this small town, and you know, I stopped for a red light, turned green, and I drove through it, and I'd only gone about a half a block, and this cop car pulled up and pulled me over. And they said, that was it? And I said, well, it was okay at that point. He came up to the car and opened the car door and asked me to get out, and I fell out. And he arrested me for being drunk. I said, I think he set me up. There's two guys, one of them was named John, the other's name was Sam. And they laughed. And they began to tell me some things about them and how they drank and some of the things that that had occurred while they were drinking. And I was really surprised. I was really surprised is that when they told me how they drank and the way they drank and what they drank, especially John. John was a master sergeant stationed at Luke Air Force Base there, and I'd just gotten out of the Navy. I'd just been surveyed out of the Navy for drinking, but anyway, and you know, my departure was how I called it, and they had the way they called it. But I had a real sense of identification with this guy, and the other guy, Sam, was a little bit older, but, you know, he was, and I enjoyed the things he talked about. And these guys, they seemed all right, and they really seemed to know what they were talking about. And so they said, you know, we're in a recovery program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's something that maybe you want to look at. And, you know, if you don't have a drinking problem, you'll be able to make a determination. But you need some more information. And would you like to go to a meeting? Now, I assumed this Alcoholics Anonymous thing was a lot like the Elks or the Lions or something. They met like once a month, you know. So I said, sure, I'd like to go with you. They said, well, let's go. Son of a gun, you know. Just my luck. Of all nights, this is the time of the month when this A&A meeting is going on, and I had to be here. But I went to the meeting with them that night. And it's interesting because I was sober, and I remember a lot about that first night. I even remember the name of the guy that was sharing, and his name was Benny, and he had about 10 years sober at that time. And this was John and Sam's home group. And they introduced me, and there was about 10 people in the room. And I don't know, I felt okay in this room. You know, as strange as it was, I didn't feel as out of place. As I knew going over there, I was going to be embarrassed. I was going to go in this room, and people would think I was in there because I drank too much. And I was thinking all the way over how I'm going to handle this. If someone was going to come up and say, hi, are you here because you drink too much? You know, I knew this was going to happen. I was going to say, well, no, not really. I'm going to do a paper this fall in college. And I want to take some notes and find out about this. But nobody asked me that question. They just smiled and giggled, and the boys and the girls hugged each other. I liked that part. I didn't know how long you had to be around before you started that. But if it was only two or three times, I could do that. I was married, but I don't want you to think for one moment that I let that get in the way of me. Well, let's go on with this story. Well, we attended that meeting, and at the end of the meeting, there was an interesting thing happened. This was John's home group, and since that was my first night AA meeting, they appointed John as my sponsor. Now, that sounds maybe a little strange here today, but really, that's what they did at one time. You know, you didn't shop around and find your sponsors, they assign them. You know, hell, if I'd been allowed to shop around, I'd have found one that was still drinking. You know, I'd been loving something. Anyway, John was assigned to me as a sponsor. He had 2 years sober, and to me, that was like 20. I mean, first of all, I couldn't imagine why anyone would not want to drink for 2 years. I couldn't, and especially, he's a GI. I mean, GIs don't not drink. I mean, why are you even in the Air Force if you don't drink? However, he was, he took me home, and he said, well, I'll be over to pick you up tomorrow night. I said, tomorrow night? You mean they have another one of those meetings this month? He said, yeah. I said, well, okay. Sure enough, he came the next night. We went to another meeting. He took me home the next night. He says, well, I'll be over to pick you up tomorrow night. I said, how many of these damn meetings did they have? And he says, oh, just about one every night. I said, no shit. And I said, do you go to one every night? And he said, no, I usually go to two. But he says, you're kind of new at this, and I'm easing up on you. So I got away from this fanatic, went in the house. Took this book that he made me take my good hard-earned money and buy, a blue book. Found the chapter in there to the wife and made her read it. She wasn't any crazier about this program than me, I can tell you that. One thing she did like about it, for two or three days I hadn't had a drink.
So she began to be kind of supportive of it in an offhand way. You see, they're scared to death because they always know it's just waiting for the other shoe to drop. I was about 3 weeks into this deal, hadn't taken a drink, was going to meeting every night, was meeting people I liked, and it was kind of fun, you know. By this time, I could hug the girls. And, of course, they told me that there were some other things they shouldn't do, and I didn't like that part of it. But John was being real nice to me. And surprisingly, I was accumulating a little money. And I mean little, but it was money. You know, it was just... I had a friend, though, a high school friend that was now a school teacher, and he was teaching school in Colorado. He and his wife came out to visit with us in December. Stayed with us. And when I told him what I was doing, I was going to this Alcoholics Anonymous because I had a drinking problem. He was just in disbelief. He said, "Keith, what are you doing to yourself?" He said, "You know, before long, everybody will find out about that. Then what are you going to do?" He said, "You're not an alcoholic." He said, "Man," he said, "I've known you for a lot of years." He said, "You've had a lot of stress. You've had a lot of bad breaks." They said, "Man, you're not an alcoholic. This guy's a school teacher, went to college." Started to make a lot of sense to me. And he was a long-time school friend. Is he going to tell me something that would hurt myself? Well, of course not. And the more I thought about it, the more he made sense. How could I be? For crying out loud, I was only 25 years old. I had a job as an engineer at Goody Aerospace. I mean, put that together. Does that spell alcoholic? Now, I might say that I didn't look at the other side of the ledger where it said I'd been drinking since I was 15 years old, almost on a daily basis. That I had been to jail a lot of times up to that point. Did you know how many at that time, how many times I've been in jail? I've been surveyed out of the Navy, 7 years in the Navy, for my alcoholism. I've been in psychiatric wards twice. My wife had separated from me for 6 months and 9 months because of my drinking. Everybody in my family was absolutely scared and petrified of me. But he was a school teacher and gone to college. Now, why would he lie to me? That made a lot more sense. See, I wasn't being as objective as he was. 31 days sober, my first tour in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I drank again. And I was to drink on and off again for the next 13 years. Now, I did not go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous rather frequently, as a matter of fact. I hid out in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is where I came to when I got in trouble. This is where I came when the heat was on. When either that wife or the next wife or the girlfriend was leaving, when the job was on the line. This is the suggested program. Judges suggested that I come, and I did. Brought my little court chit. Did that for a long time before a bartender proved to me that he could sign it and I could get it just as cleared with the court as I could, as if I'd had it in an AA meeting. Oh, he circumvented some meetings for me. But I couldn't grasp this thing for the simple reason is that I didn't want to quit drinking. I could tell you a lot of stories why nothing happened, but the truth was, I didn't want to hear so much that I quit drinking, and I was miserable. They already knew by this time that I was a real alcoholic. But when it talks about admitting it to our innermost self, it had not penetrated that far. I had a friend of mine at Thanksgiving, we went out and had dinner, real nice lady, non-alcoholic, drinks occasionally like some of us, some people that we know. She had a glass of wine with dinner and did the thing that just absolutely drives a hard-drinking alcoholic right up the wall. She drank half of it, set it over, and never finished it. Now, we finished the rest of our dinner and dessert and everything else, and all I can see is this half-glass wine. So no matter what we were talking about, I could see this half-glass wine. And finally, I asked her in the nicest way I could, "Why don't you drink that fucking wine?" And she says, "Well, I rarely drink a whole glass of anything." And I said, "Why is that?" And she says, "Well, I don't know. It affects me funny, and to be honest with you, I feel a little insecure, and I feel unsure of myself, and I just don't like that feeling." You know, and I must have stared at this lady in disbelief for 5 minutes. You see, because that's what I felt like before I took the drink. That's why I drank. I mean, being afraid and insecure and unsure of myself was the way, I think I was born that way. I think I came out screaming when I was born. I don't think they had to pat me on the ass. I think I came out that way. I had just been kicked out of a nice, warm place where I was fed fairly regularly, and I didn't have to make any decisions. And I know later on, when they kept locking me up in psycho wards and putting me in jail and everything else, that old familiar feeling came back. I was in a nice, warm place. They fed me once in a while, and I didn't have to make any decisions. Now, I didn't like going to jail in those other places, but you know what? I was pretty comfortable once I was in there. I just settled in. And when I got outside of there, you see, and I got out in the real world where life, where people were doing this thing called life, I got unsure, and I got afraid, and I drank, and I felt okay. I could never figure out where you drink to and you're okay, and the other part goes on. And I used to tell these guys when I'd go to these AA meetings, I used to say, you know, I hear what you're saying, and you talk about a lot of stuff. You talk about this book, and you talk about these 12 steps. And I said, they seem like a good moral code. They're something like I could appreciate. But you see, I need something where I don't drink long enough so I get whatever it is you guys got. And one guy one day told me, he says, Keith, rarely we see anybody get sober who continues to drink. I didn't need smart-ass answers. I needed hard, solid stuff that I could deal with. But the essence of what he told me was true. There was nothing that I could do until that moment when I made the one courageous decision, the only one that I was capable of making, was that I would not take anything of any alcohol whatsoever and put it down my throat. It took me 13 years to reach that point where I could do it. 13 years, long after there was any great experience coming from it. There was nothing really derived from alcohol at that point. Usually by the time I would take that first drink, I went into a blackout, and it was the next day. And I was always sick in those last days. I just never felt good. So I was unemployable. I couldn't work. And I would try. I have actually, near the end, I was taking the wife at that time to work. And with every intention, I was going to go out and find a job that day. I'd really have tears in my eyes. And I'd leave there and I'd go over to a place called the Sage and Sand that opened at 6 o'clock in the morning to have the one drink that I needed to get the feeling okay so I could go on out and get that job. And it was 11 or 12 o'clock at night. Here she was with tears in her eyes. I've been looking all over for you. It's time to go home. And we'd go home. And the next day, my day would start all over again. That's the way it was for me. I don't know if I had, any real peace that ever came with drinking. Now, I try to think about times that I thought were the good times. But, you know, those good times were always followed by some unpleasant thing. It didn't necessarily mean that every time I drank, I went to jail or lost my job or got a divorce. But there were always some things that happened the next morning that made me feel ashamed and embarrassed and some of the things that I ended up. And even though I felt like I started out in a very low station in life, you know, I was born on a tenant farm in Oklahoma. Father was an alcoholic and a very sick Al-Anon mother and very poor. I've heard some people sometimes say, you know, the nice thing about those days when you was poor, it was before the government come out with all these standards so that we could actually judge and let you know when you were poor. You know, we just all looked pretty much alike where I grew up in Oklahoma, so I didn't know what poor was until my old man lost our farm in a poker game one night. Wound up moving into town, and my first day on the schoolyard when they were choosing up teams to play some silly little game, and they got down and there was only me and these two Mexican fellows left to choose. And one guy looks over at the other one and he said, what do you want to do with these three guys? He says, you can go ahead and take those two wetbacks and that white trash. You know, I'm 8 years old. I don't know what that means. I don't know what any of it means. I don't know what a wetback is. I don't know what white trash is. But there was something I knew. Whatever it wasn't good. And I went home that night. My brother very angrily told me what it was and told me I didn't ever have to have anyone call me that. But you know what that told me? Now, those kids out on the schoolyard, the very kid that said that, You know, within 30 seconds, that thing was gone. They had forgotten all about it. But I can tell you, 44 years later, I'm standing up here right now, and it's clear as a bell to me. So if you think that you can't say something to a kid and they don't remember it, you're crazy. I remember it crystal clear. I can stand right here and see the faces of every one of those boys standing around that schoolyard. And I can hear him saying those words, the two wetbacks and the white trash, very clearly. But it told me that I was different from other people. It told me that I wasn't as good as other people. And at that age, I don't know what, if you're impressionable or not, but brother, it hit home to me. And so I didn't know what to do to make up the difference. I couldn't change my station. I couldn't change my clothes. I mean, I pretty well had to wear whatever my folks put on me. So I tried to figure out what I could do that would make me acceptable. And I worked very hard academically. I had to have straight A's. I had to be the teacher's pet. When it came to athletics, I did everything that I could. I worked three times as hard as some guys that it came real easy to, because I had to be accepted at everything. And this went along, right up until I was 15 years old. And at 15, I was accomplishing all those things I needed to be accepted. I was in my second year of high school and was playing varsity basketball. I was captain of the baseball team. I was president of the student council. I was going with a head cheerleader. I was a straight A student, headed for valedictorian. And I was reasonably acceptable, except to me. And when all those people accepted me in the world, I still couldn't understand why I felt the way that I did. I just didn't understand. My brother come home on leave from the army. Wanted to know if I wanted to go riding around with him and some of his buddies and drink a little Colorado Kool-Aid, Coors beer. And just to be with this guy, I mean, this was my hero. Paratrooper, served in Korea. You know, I idolized this guy. And for to be asked to go with these men and to drink a little beer, even though I hadn't drank any, it sounded like a wonderful idea. And we got in the back seat of that Kaiser car that night. Yes, Virginia, there was a Kaiser at one time. John remembers, don't you, John? When I got out of that car, 25 years of my life had passed. And I don't know what happened. But I do remember taking that second can of beer. The first one was not too wonderful. But something happened with that second can of beer, and all of a sudden, my life changed. All of a sudden, I no longer needed all those little ribbons and medals and letters on my jacket. I no longer needed those A's. I no longer needed any of that stuff. I not only felt as good as anybody I'd ever met in my life sitting in the back seat of that car that night, but I felt better than. I could not believe that. I couldn't believe how I felt. I couldn't believe that I was riding around with four of the dumbest guys I'd ever been in a car with in my life. Paratrooper. This guy talked and sounded like an Okie. You know, never seemed to brush his teeth. I don't care if he's my hero brother. I just didn't quite like the look of him. Matter of fact, he didn't look so damn tough to me. Of course, he proved to me that night he was a little bit tougher than what I did. That's another lesson I never learned very well that night. I can tell you this. I never screwed with another paratrooper, but you know what? They come in different sizes. There's always a paratrooper in every bar. But I got out of that car, and with my life changed, I missed school the next day, which was kind of a harboring of things to come. And it's tough, as some of you may know, when you're starting to drink at 15. It's not as easy to get that age. But you know, by 16, I was actually drinking in bars. 17, I was able to buy booze for other kids. And by 17, I'd far outgrown high school. I had done everything that you could possibly do there. I had acquitted myself very well, and it was time to leave. I'd just gotten out of my junior year and got drunk, wrecked my car. And her parents didn't like me showing up at the house anymore at 3 o'clock in the morning honking my horn. I was a man. I didn't need that stuff. I was going to join the Navy where they really knew how to handle guys like me. And I joined the Navy, and I found a wonderful new home. It was the exact environment I was looking for. Now, I even enjoyed boot camp. In fact, when I was in boot camp, remember, I came out of a farming community. And I went to Navy boot camp, which is only a little bit harder than Marine Corps boot camp. But nevertheless, it just wasn't that difficult. That was my friend, Bert.
And a guy, I told a guy one time, he says, one thing about when you get this boot camp finished, it's a lot better than this. And I said, are you kidding me? Hell, I could stay 20 years if this is as good as it ever got. I love this stuff. And I made a decision right then. I was going to make a career out of the United States Navy. And time passed, and I can tell you, it functioned well for me. I got drunk every night, and I was just lucky that the way the Navy was built, it was designed for guys like me, and I always got to know who I needed to know to keep me out of trouble. And I got shipped overseas rather early on, which helps, you know. Things are a lot different over there, and I spent 4 or 5 years over there, come back, reenlisted, and wound up in the real world and the real Navy, and they didn't have any use for me whatsoever. Things had changed. So a couple, 3 years of being in the sober stateside Navy, and my being put in a psycho ward a couple of times for trying to commit suicide, they told me to go away. And we had an agreement. I wouldn't bother them anymore if they wouldn't bother me. And I took all my benefits, got out of a discharge. You know, this is just how interested they were in anything to get rid of me. And I went for it. I got out, and one more time, I'd been kicked out where a place I'd been used to having people take care of me. I was married at this time, had 2 children and 1 on the way. And maybe I always took care of all those things. I didn't know what to do. I didn't even know how to get a job. But first of all, you got to go look for one. But I didn't. They'd given me a very good education, a good background, pre-engineering school, electronics engineering, and it took me a year and a half laying out drunk and working in the oil patch and driving trucks and everything else before I figured out that maybe I could use that in civilian life, and I did. And that's how I wound up with that job at Goodyear Aerospace. And I pursued that, and I lost some pretty good jobs, but I got in the computer industry, and it was booming at that time. This was in the 60s. And through some unbelievable set of circumstances, I wound up at the White Sands Missile Range and got some good marks down there. I don't know how that happened because I was still drunk there every day, missed a lot of work. They put me into another special project that sent me to Houston at the Manned Spacecraft Center. And this is when NASA was in its heyday. We were getting ready to put a man on the moon, and I was getting to play a part in that. That should have been absolutely exciting. It should have been one of the greatest times of my life. But I was drunk a lot, you know. And I don't know that I had a full essence of what was going on. But nevertheless, here I was one day in 1967 on an upward career in a very exciting field. And in 1969, I was living in MacArthur Park, panhandling quarters, and going down to the blood bank on Tuesdays and Thursdays to get plasma. And whenever I could possibly squeeze in a night at the rescue mission, I did that. That's quite a dramatic drop. And you know, it's not really like stepping off into an elevator shaft. It didn't really happen that way. It seemed to have, but I had been setting myself up for that for a long, long time. And it's interesting is that I took each step downward when I said, if I ever do that, I'll never drink again. But you know, I would do that, and once the humiliation, the embarrassment, or the time served came past, I'd take that next step of something else that I would not do. I remember standing at an airport in Burbank, California, with 4 other guys. And we had on leg chains, and we had on wrist bracelets, and we were chained together. And was being taken back to Colorado on some phony charge of checks, or I don't know. Bank gives you all these checks. I used them all. But anyway, I was being relocated. But we were in Burbank and had this very small plane that they were flying all of us back to Colorado for and sundry other charges. And I remember standing there, and I told this deputy sheriff there, I said, hey, man, I got to go to the bathroom. And he said, you're not alone here, pal. You know, there's some other guys with you. And I said, well, I know that. And he said, what do you guys think? You want to go to the bathroom? He said, screw it. You know, that's the way it is. But my bladder took it about as long as it could, and it gave way. And I remember a woman with 2 little kids standing there, and the little boy says, Mama, Mama, look at that man. He's wet in his pants. Degrading, humiliating. And I didn't drink again until I got out of jail. See, I said something like that. I could not imagine me ever reaching a point, being in a position like that, and ever drinking again. But it was easy. It was easy. It was easier to drink and to escape than it was to not drink and have the courage and the guts to step through whatever I had to step through, not to pick up that next drink. That little spell, by the way, is what got me in a deeper place than I'd ever been in before. I came out of that after about 4 or 5 months in jail, and on this condition, I was given what they call a deferred judgment. Deferred judgment's where you plead guilty to the crime, and then they give you a probationary period, and if you fill that probationary period, they will dismiss the charges. However, you plead guilty to this thing, and if any part of that, you violate that probation, you immediately go to prison for whatever length of time that you've been sentenced to, and mine was 2 years. So it meant I had to do probation. If I violated it and was busted, I'd be sent to prison directly for 2 years. One of the provisions in this thing was that I would not drink. Now, one of the people that had pressed this charge against me met me on the courthouse step, and he says, they asked me if I would agree to this plea bargain. And when I found out that one of the conditions was that if you drink, that you would go to prison, I agreed to it. You want to know why? I'm going to tell you why. Because there's no way that you can go 2 years without drinking, let alone go 2 weeks. But you know, when you drink and they bust you and they send to prison, I want you to know something, big boy. You sent yourself there. I didn't. You got your chance with me, but you're going to blow it. But you can go there, and I'm not going to feel a damn bit guilty about it, but you'll know that you did it to yourself. The guy was vindictive. There was no question about that. He was still aggravated because I gave him a hot check to put gas in a car. Of course, the car was his. And the lady was driving was his wife. And we went to California together, and it pissed him off. So he wanted me out of action for a while, and it almost worked. But I really tried. I knew that the only way I'd ever see anybody stay sober that drank like I drank was right here in these rooms in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I asked him if I could be transferred to Arizona because it's really necessary for me to be in a more comfortable environment to try to do this sobriety kick. And they let me do that. And I got there and I started going to AA meetings. One a week, regular clockwork. Unless I was busy that night. I did that for about 3 or 4 months. Most miserable time of sobriety my entire life. Then I wound up one night getting real lucky, getting a chance to take a girl out on a date, and I was absolutely petrified. I didn't know what to do. I had never dated a girl sober. I really had some visions of getting laid. I didn't know how you did it. But I was afraid to drink, but it didn't say anything in there about not smoking dope. So compromising on that one point, and a very helpful nephew that was running drugs out of Arizona at the time, I took my date to a play, and that night we went over to his place and smoked a little stuff, and I couldn't stop, you see. And it was a Christmas party coming up, and I didn't know how in the world to go to this Christmas party and not drink. I didn't know how anybody did that. I thought about going there and getting something like 7-Up that looked like gin, which I like to drink, and a twist of lime, walk around that. But I was afraid if I set it down, somebody would drink it. They'd say, what the hell is this? This ain't booze. This candy ass ain't drinking. I couldn't stand that kind of embarrassment. So I was going to put real booze in it. I just wouldn't drink it. Must have done this at some time in your life. But I got drunk that night, and for the first time, I couldn't get sober. I really, really couldn't. For the first time in my life, I could not get sober. I just couldn't get it together. And this was during that period of time I was telling you about. This is when I met that last ex-wife of mine. I was on a running drunk when I met her. She had those things that I'd really looked for in a woman. She had a job, a car, and a house. And we hit it off. One of her conditions was that we get married. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me. I finally hit my bottom. The probation officer showed up out there one day and he says, I need to talk to you. And I was in terrible shape. He said, have you been drinking? I said, no, sir, I can't drink. He said, I know you can't drink, but have you been drinking? I said, no, sir. He said, you're a lying son of a bitch. I want to tell you something, pal. You either go into a rehabilitation program, a residential program for 30 days, or I'm going to see that you go to prison for 2 years. I said, well, when do you have to have my decision? I didn't get high marks for being smart. He said, this is Tuesday, and you better be in one of those programs by Friday. And I said, I don't have any money. I don't have anything else. I don't have any insurance. How in the world am I going to do this? And he said, I think you need to figure that out. So I got on the phone, and I called National Council on Alcoholism. And I said, I've had a little drinking problem here lately. It's nothing serious. But I also don't have a job right now, and I need to know if there are any programs in Phoenix for indigents. And they said, well, as a matter of fact, there's a couple of them. One of them is named Maverick House, and the other one is named Calvary. Well, I grew up in the Southern Baptist community. I knew what Calvary meant. I said, that one's out. No Jesus rocks for me stuff, you know. Right? Maverick, yeah. Like that. So I went out there Friday night to interview, and that's what you had to do. This was a free program, and so they were very careful about who they gave these freebies away to. And went out there in a clean shirt, looked pretty good. Went in to interview with this guy. His name was Bob Pickens, and I sit down, and we visited for a little bit. And he says, well, why do you want to come in here? And I said, well, Bob, been having a little bit of a drinking problem. I don't think it's too serious, but my wife does. And I said, we just got married, and you know, I don't want to do anything to jeopardize this marriage. And so I thought maybe I would come into this program, and maybe we'd catch this thing early enough before I really got into real problems. And he said, well, I can understand that. He said, now the possibility of you going to prison for 2 years, does that have any bearing on it? I said, well, yeah, that has something to do with it. Guy, the probation officer knew there was only two places I'd go, and he had already called him. I mean, you know, he had pre-qualified me and said, if this sucker doesn't show up, you let me know because I'm going to put out a warrant for his arrest. So I wound up in this program. They wouldn't even let me go home that night. They made my wife come and get the car and everything else. They kept me. I said, well, I'm out of clothes. They said, I'll bring you something. You know, they wouldn't let me out of this joint. And because I was scared to death. I mean, man, if I can just buy some time, I'll get out of here. I'll figure this thing out. But they kept me. And the next morning, they took me in this little room. There was about 10 people, and this was an old converted motel, run-down place. And their little meeting rooms were just stripped-down rooms, and they had concrete floors, and you took your pillow off your bed, and that's what you used to sit on. So they brought me in there, and they introduced me to these people, and then they introduced me to this guy that was supposed to be my counselor, or whatever they called him in. And I looked at this guy, and I said, wow, this guy looked rough. I don't mean he looked tough. I mean he looked rough. I mean like he'd fallen in the back of a cement mixer or something. And he didn't look anything like any therapist I'd ever seen. They said, Ray here is about 5 years sober. He spent better than 30 years on the Bowery in New York City as a Skid Row wino, but he's kind of helping people today get sober and stay sober. I was a little offended by that. I thought, Jesus, I'm in trouble here, and they're giving me some wino instead of a guy with degrees behind his name. But you know, that very first morning, something magical happened. He says, Keith, why don't you come over and sit beside me? I'm really glad you're here, and I've waited for you for a long time. Now, see, that sounds kind of simple, but when he said it, when he looked in my eye, I don't know what to tell you, except I knew that he meant it, and it moved me in a way like no one's ever moved me since. So I sat beside Ray, and I just soaked up everything this old man said like a sponge. Man, I mean to tell you. Now, this wasn't your traditional, typical recovery center. These were guys out of the AA program, and the only thing they used as a treatment program was a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 Steps. And that's what you did in that 30 days while you was in there. You read that big book, and you talked about it, and you begin working those steps. Now, one thing it reminded you of is this is a familiarity, guys. This doesn't count. When you get out there, you get a real sponsor, and you're going to do these steps right. And when I got out of there, they said, you're going to do 90 meetings in 90 days, like many of you have been told. I thought, my God, boy, this is, if I do this. I told Ray, I said, you know, is this every day? Go to a meeting every day. He said, yeah. I remember Judge telling me that one time, too. Judge would give me the same thing one time. He says, I'll tell you what. I'm either going to give you 30 days in jail, or you go to 30 AA meetings. I said, do I have to go to meetings every day? No. Made up my decision, and I said, well, I'll go ahead and go to jail. He said, no, you're not. You're going to meetings. In fact, you're going to go to 60 meetings. I hated judges. But, you know, I got out and I started going to those meetings, and that 30 days in there of not drinking gave me the one thing that I needed at that point in time. I needed that physical sobriety. I needed to not have to have that drink. And I was scared to death. I was scared of going to prison for 2 years. I was scared to pick up a drink. I was scared. I knew that for 14 months, any way that I could, I had to hold on to not drinking. And I got a hold of AA and I went to meetings. I went to two meetings, three meetings a day. I mean, I did not miss a day. And when I've been sober nearly a year, these guys, this one meeting I was going to, I used to meet them for coffee every afternoon. And one of the guys there that helped set up for this one Thursday meeting, it was my home group, he said, "Keith, I got to go to Texas for 2 weeks, and they need someone to help them set up. Would you come in and help them those 2 weeks when I'm gone?" When I learned in the military, you don't volunteer for anything, but hell, for 2 weeks, I could do it. And I said, "Yeah, sure, I'll help them." I never saw that guy again. I wound up doing that thing for 2 years, and it was good for me. The best thing that ever happened to me, though, is I looked forward, and I counted those days and those months, and they passed. And finally, the day came that I could walk into that probation office, and they would sign that thing off, and I was free and clear, and the charges would be dismissed against me, and I would have completed my probation. And I looked for that day, because you know what that meant? That meant they couldn't do a thing to me if I decided I wanted to drink again. And I remember going in there that day, and I was scared and I was excited at the same time. And when the guy signed it off and he said, "Well, Keith, I'm really proud of what you've been doing," he said, "I hope you're just man enough to keep it up." I walked out the front door of that probation office in Phoenix, Arizona, looked right catty-corner across 13th and Roosevelt there, and I saw that Joe's Bar and Tavern. And I thought, you know, I can walk right over right now, and I'm a free man, and I can have a drink. And I'm not going to today. I don't want to feel like it today, but I may tomorrow. You know, I've been doing that same story now for nearly 14 years. See, I know today I can drink if I want to. And I feel pretty good this evening because I didn't drink today, and I got up feeling pretty good this morning because I didn't drink yesterday. And that's been a pretty good combination for me. Sobriety has been really good to me. I've had some really interesting trips. I've had some real turmoil. I was fortunate enough to come in some money early sobriety, which is bad. I lost it. I was fortunate enough to get some pretty good jobs, and they went to my head, and I lost them. Didn't get fired, though. Never been fired yet in sobriety. But you know, I was 10 years sober, and I was laid off a job that I really liked. I really enjoyed that job. And vice president of that company had hired me about 3 days before that, had died in a hotel room at Tropicana of alcohol poisoning. He was a periodic, and he was on a 3-month sober stretch, and he started drinking that night, and he died. He was 36 years old, and his wife was 6 months pregnant with their first child. And that really impacted me. I mean, it really set me back a little bit. This was in January, and then I got laid off behind that. And I had accumulated a little money, and I wasn't too worried about it. I thought, well, I need this break. You know, things are not wonderful right now. I need some time anyway. I need some time to myself. I need to reflect. And I was very active in the program. I was in a lot of service work. I was on committees and roundups, and I was speaking. I was sponsoring people. I just didn't feel very good. It seemed like things were going as well as I wanted them to. But about 3 months into my little vacation, it seems that the last couple of 3 years, I had not quite figured some of my taxes as well as I should have. And the interesting restitution service decided we need to work out a deal where I paid them back this money that I had miscalculated on. The first thing they did is took every dime that I had in the bank. So, you know, suddenly for the first time, I had car payments come and due that I didn't have the money to pay for. I had rent come and due that I didn't have money to pay for. And I didn't have a job. I'd had a job ever since I'd been in the program. Ever since I'd been sober for 10 years, I'd managed to keep a job. I didn't have one. Let me tell you what. I was 49 years old, and all of a sudden, it seemed like I couldn't get a job. I seemed as unemployable as it was when I first came into the program, went months, because I couldn't get a job. All of a sudden, I was unemployable again. And I don't know if I was going through the change of life or what, because I thought it was because I was too old now, and nobody wanted to hire me. I was involved in a relationship that had gone absolutely nuts at that point. Maybe it's because she was absolutely nuts. I love nutty women. God bless them. They just don't make enough of them anymore. But Wes is shaking his head. He says, "That's not true. They still do. They just didn't issue me one lately in the last couple of years." Nevertheless, things were just not going all that wonderful. And I didn't quit going to meetings, and I didn't quit sponsoring people, but I tell you, every day seemed to be another uphill battle. I just could not seem to get on top of this. And I began to get scared because I couldn't find any relief from this pain that was going on in me. It was pain as severe as I had ever suffered in my life. Emotional pain, mental pain. It was agony. I'm telling you. And at 10 years sober, I began thinking, I can't pick up another drink. I won't do that. But I don't want to live this way anymore either. And I was thinking about suicide. Now, I wasn't so sober that I didn't look at suicide in a rather exciting way. I thought about going in the garage, pulling this garage door shut, putting the rags all around it and letting the car run. And I was fortunate I had a car phone in there that I knew there were some people that weren't home that weekend. And I would call their answering machine and I would leave the last moments of my tragic life on that tape. And someday in a meeting like this, they would play this tape for newcomers. Now, you don't have to do this if you don't want to. I could see I'd be a legacy in this program. But I dwelt on that far too long because it became real to me. And I was approaching the point in a couple of days where I was going to have the opportunity to actually put this little mental trip into action. Now, I belong to a No Rules group, my home group. It meets 7 days a week at 7 a.m. at the TIE Club, which is still there. It's just covering through a little burned ashes right now, but it shall, like Phoenix, rise again. So don't mark it off your meeting list yet. We'll be back here in a beautiful new building in March. But nevertheless, I was going to that meeting every morning. And I went to a meeting this particular morning, obsessed with my last day or two to see what happens to all these people. And after the meeting, as I started to leave, one of the people there had about 25 years at the time. And he says, "Where are you going, Keith?" I said, "Well, I'm going." He said, "Why are you such a rebound? You got a job. You ain't got any place to go." And he was right, you know. And I said, "Well, I guess I'm not in a hurry." He said, "Well, why don't you sit down and have some coffee with me?" So we sit down. He says, "What's going on with you?" "Well, there's something going on here. And you know, you're in trouble. Your house is on fire and you don't know it." And I said, "Well, God damn, John." And I went into this whole routine. Look what's happened to me. Look what happened. I lost my job. I lost my best friend. I'm in a relationship that one of us is going to kill each other. I can't get a job. I'm too old. I'm unemployable. I'm behind on my car payment. I'm behind on my rent. I'm 10 years sober, and this is what's happening to me." And he listened to me very patiently. And we talked a little while longer. And as I got ready to leave, he said, "Keith Thomas, this is the last day of your life. Live it well." I left there and I got my car and I was driving back to the house and I thought, what the hell does that mean? That didn't make any sense at all. Now, I had been in AA long enough to learn, though, at that time, that anytime anybody said anything to you that made no sense absolutely at all, there was something really powerful in it. I had also been taught something else that I hadn't taken advantage of. And that's we do an inventory on things that we don't understand what's going on in our life. And I had not done this. And that cued me as that maybe that's what I needed to do. And I got home and I took out a yellow pad and I sat down and I started writing. And I didn't know what John meant at the time, but because I didn't know where else to start, I put up the top of the page, "The last day of my life." Now that's been nearly 4 years ago. But I learned something very dramatically about that. And it's short. And I want to read it to you. And I read it to you as much for me as for you. But I want you to know what state of mind I was in at the time that I wrote it. It's the last day of my life. This was the last day of my life. I'd want it to seem like any other day. I'd like to start it as usual, early. I'd like to wake up at 5 a.m., put on my sweats and tennies, start the coffee, and go for my 2 mile morning speed walk. When I got back to the house, I'd pour a cup of coffee, go in the backyard, and watch the sunrise brighten my last day on earth. I would make my bed as usual, shower, do 15 minutes of yoga and 15 minutes of meditation. I wouldn't dawdle with prayer. Since there is an immortal soul, I'll have an eternity to spend praying. So I think I've spent a little time reflecting about the nature of my existence and some of the experiences I've had on this planet. I hope I would not have many apologies or regrets. Excuse me. If this would be my last day on Earth, I wouldn't have time for a lot of amends. It's a cinch I couldn't make up for a lifetime of mistakes in one day. I'd want to spend most of the day outside. I love God's great outdoors. I'd want to see something really funny so I could laugh long and hard. I'd want to see an unselfish act of kindness. And I'd want to see somebody so happy they cried. There are some people I would like to hold close one last time, so I'd go to an AA meeting. I'd want to hear only my favorite music and wear my favorite clothes. Maybe I'd even buy something new to wear on my last day on Earth, something I've secretly always wanted to wear but was too self-conscious to do it. I'd want to tell as many of the people that I love them, and I probably would not make a lot of effort to see people I don't like. My last day on Earth would certainly end all my worries about tomorrow, so with that out of the way, it should be a pretty good day. I probably wouldn't eat a lot of stuff I like, such as ice cream, pastries, or candy bars. I wouldn't want to be sick on my last day on Earth. I guess for that same reason, I wouldn't start smoking again either, even if it was just for one day. I wouldn't drink on my last day on Earth either. I'd want to feel everything and be completely aware of every last single fractional second that I was alive. I wouldn't write a last-minute will or do anything else that should have already been done. I wouldn't call or write a last letter to my kids. Whatever needed to be said should have already been said. I'd read the court-martial scene from the book Catch-22. I would swim, get a full-body massage, and have my sister Louise's roast beef for lunch. I'd have potato soup for supper. I'm a country boy. I'd like that. For my last meal on Earth, I'd want it to be potato soup with crisp bacon crumbled up. I would want my last day on Earth to end at midnight so I could watch the sunset and see a sky full of stars for the last time. And as my day on Earth was nearing its end, I'd want to make love to someone who loves me and would miss me. And I'd like to hold them close as their last seconds ticked away. I want you to know when I finished this and I reread it, I made some startling discoveries. One is that on my last day of Earth, on Earth, I wouldn't ask to have a new home up on Sunrise Mountain. I wouldn't ask to be married to the newest beauty queen. I wouldn't ask for a Rolls Royce, or I wouldn't ask to win the lottery. Strangely enough, what I had written on this paper were things that I could do every day of my life. You see, Alcoholics Anonymous had given me that. The sobriety I had at that moment writing these papers was the very thing that I needed to do these things that I said would make me happy on my last day on Earth. I haven't had too many problems since then, folks, I'll tell you right now. Every day that I live and do the simple things that bring me simple pleasures, I find gratitude. I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the people in it. I love the people like John who love me enough to see the problems and to take the time and to give me the truth and a program that allowed me to pick up a pencil and a piece of paper and have the truth revealed to me as it really is, not somewhere up in my head. Because I can tell you as those thoughts pass from head to hand, they go through the heart and the truth is revealed to you on these pages. Thank you very much for having me tonight. May God bless and keep all of you.